You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 50. Facebook is definitely not advertising this episode, I can tell you that much.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome everyone to The Local Maximum. I'm your host, Max Sklar. Joining me today, I've got a co-host, Aaron. Are you there?
I am here. Good evening, or morning, or afternoon, wherever.
Well, whenever this
whatever
goes
whatever time
out,
it is when you're listening.
Yeah, when you're listening. Sometimes people, I've heard, I think it's like that late night show, Coast to Coast AM, where he goes, good evening, good afternoon, or good morning, depending on where you are in the world. But this is asynchronous, so this could be happening, you could have two people in New York listening at two completely different times. So certainly the greetings are, why don't we just use, what time is it here on the East Coast right now as we're recording at 10:45 at
yep.
night? All right. So good evening, Aaron. How you doing?
not to go too far down that inside baseball rabbit hole, but
yeah.
Do you have stats on, well, I guess you would have stats on when downloads happen. There's no way to tell when people actually listened to an episode.
Yes. Well, when down. Well, yes. Yeah. Exactly. but I think there's a correlation there. A lot of news for the podcast as we start the year. I filed for an S corp for the podcast. Hopefully, turn this into a little business. Not a big one. I'm still going to be going once a week, but we'll see what we could do. I did not know that I get an official seal if I. If I file for an S corp, so that is, if I knew that, man, I'd be making S corps all the time. Those official seals are awesome. Don't you wish you had one?
I'm jealous. Although being primarily an audio format, do you have an audio equivalent of the seal? Can we
no.
insert some sound effects to that? nature.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Was it Harley Davidson that tried to trademark a sound? As associated with their brand.
What sound? Like vroom or something?
No, it was some, well, Harleys are sometimes referred to as hogs. And so I feel like it was some sort of pig grunt like noise, but they wanted, I think they were trying to get an audio trademark, and I can't remember whether that was laughed out of court or they were visionaries.
Well, companies are always trying to get trademark and anything that they can get their hands on. All right. So today we had, two choices. One was to talk about all the new technology that's coming out in the next couple of years. And the other one is to talk about how the current incumbents are behaving badly and complain about them. And it sounds like we went with the latter.
Yeah, we've opted for the less optimistic of the two choices.
Okay. Well, you know, I think you want the bad news first, right? And then, well, some of the bad news comes with some good news, but I think some of the technology that we're going to see in terms of 5G that we're going to see in 2019, 2020, 2021, that could wait a couple weeks, and so we'll talk about that. But today, we're going to talk about Patreon, and of course, our friends Google, and our best friend Microsoft. Or not Microsoft, sorry. I was just talking. I'm getting confused. Facebook and all the bad press they're getting, which should always be taken with a grain of salt. I'm talking about
our greatest hits there.
Yeah, well, Microsoft, I'm talking about next week with Avnish Kohli, who's the product manager on Foursquare Swarm, and we're going to talk all about Swarm. And he used to work at Microsoft, and we haven't really gone into Microsoft a whole lot, so I had a little bit of a conversation on that with him. So that will be out next week on The Local Maximum.
Looking forward to listening to it.
Yeah. All right. So the first story comes with Patreon. Now, for those of you who don't know, Patreon is this company, and I don't really use it. I don't use it for this program, and I've supported other people's podcasts, but I've and work, but I have not done it through Patreon. But it's a site where you can go on and sort of give people sort of a monthly donation to whatever they are producing. And that's been like the hit new thing for a while, I would
say,
for content.
It's very
producers.
Popular with creative types or content creators, particularly those who are putting out material at a regular basis, so it's ideal for podcasters or people making YouTube videos or things along that vein. I know a lot of webcomic creators use it for that type of stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And much like Kickstarter kind of built a fundraising infrastructure that people can use, it's nothing that you couldn't do on your own before, but it's a lot easier if somebody else is running the whole underlying infrastructure, and that's what Patreon provides.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the year, Dave Rubin, who is he's a comedian and podcaster. He's very well known. He's one of the most popular podcasts, like think Joe Rogan or something like that. I don't know. He's probably, Joe Rogan's the biggest, right? He's probably like an order of magnitude under that, but like the next tier. I could get a lot of trouble for saying, I don't know what the numbers are. But anyway, he's pretty big.
Yeah, and I haven't listened to him, but I know the name. So that's an indicator there.
Yeah. So he announced at the beginning of the year that he was leaving Patreon, mainly because of Patreon's censorship policy. They banned a podcaster at the beginning of the year known as Sargon of Akkad. Again, I've heard some of his YouTube videos. I'm not, and I've heard some of his interviews, but I listen to a lot of podcasts, so I'm not extremely familiar with his work. He used some, forbidden language, we should say, and got cut off the Patreon platform. And it's interesting to note, first of all, that he said this stuff not on his show, but on someone else's show, so not on the show that the people were supporting. And I read the transcript. It sounded like, so he used the N-word, but it sounded like he was really frustrated with like the alt-right, and so he was hurling it at the Nazis themselves. So really strange sort of a situation, wouldn't you say? But anyway, Patreon decided to ban him for that. And Dave Rubin himself was never in danger of being deplatformed here, but he is kind of a free speech advocate, I would say, a free speech maximalist. So he decided to do something about it. And he put his own money on the line by saying, by January 15th, we are off of it, and we're going to figure out what an alternative is.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are talking about making similar moves. It's not unlike when YouTube started demonetizing some channels or locking some. And I think one of the big concerns with a lot of people who are making the move now, or at least putting the support structure in so that they can make the move, is less, oh God, what do I do if they kick me off? Because, you know, there are other ways that you can reach out to your followers and
but it's so difficult.
Do that. But yeah, one, it's tough to make that transition if you're behind the eight ball. And two, if you have all of your content hosted on that site, and you know, if they want to be nice about it, they can make you, you know, invisible to your followers and put a stop on it. If they want to be mean about it, they can just cut off your access to your material that you created and posted there. And if you don't have that backed up independently on your own, then you're locked out. And
that's what scares me.
They own the terms of service, so it's completely legal for them to do that. But it's a smart move to have yourself protected against that, even if you don't jump ship immediately. And so there are a number of people who think that, either on principle or because they think they might become victim to this, are taking steps along those lines.
That's what scares me about Google Docs. And I have seen some proposals for kind of like a decentralized version of Google Docs where you can't be locked out of it, because I have some important, you know, documents and notes on that thing. Well, all of my Local Maximum show notes are on Google Docs, right? So
And I'm sure there's a way you can, you know, dump all of your data from the service, but you're not doing that on a regular basis as, you know, a backup to hard drive somewhere.
No, because I'm not, the Google Docs has been basically uninterrupted for me for 10 years. So there's no reason to believe I'm going to be shut out. But there's always that fear, like, what if one day, like, boom, it happens. And I don't know. maybe that's a misplaced fear. But anyway, he decided to do something about it. And immediately Dave Rubin going off of Patreon, and immediately the cryptocurrency community kind of flung into action, say, you got to use Bitcoin, you got to use crypto. Essentially, crypto is Bitcoin. I mean, a lot, you know, I know that people are like, oh, use Bitcoin Cash, use some, but let's focus on Bitcoin here because it's the main one, and that's really what people are talking about. I think he was a little hesitant to embrace it at first because he was saying, hey, I'm sure this is a good idea in the long run, but it's not ready right now. And he's kind of right about that. But it appears in a recent article from that we'll post on the show notes page, localmaxradio.com/50, that he now sees that the payment processors are part of the problem. So I think first he was like, okay, well, let's get rid of one middleman, which is Patreon, but we still have the payment processors, Visa and MasterCard. I think he's starting to realize that they're part of the censorship problem as well. And so now he's like, okay, we need to turn to cryptocurrency. And it's interesting that while he's embracing it, Gab.ai, which I spoke about back in episode 47 as a joke, I said Gab.ai is full of Nazis, just like Tumblr is full of porn. and by the way, that's true, but they've been also promoting Bitcoin as free speech money, which is probably pretty smart because it can't be censored and it is free speech money. If anyone needs free speech, it's probably Nazis, or in the case of Sargon, it's somebody arguing against the Nazis that gets so exasperated that they say things that are horrible or bad themselves. It's so funny to me that that's how it happened. I don't know.
So there are a couple of things I want to hit on here. One is it's very concerning that they are penalizing him for something that was in no way affiliated with the platform. I don't want to make a bad analogy here, but it would be like getting suspended from school for something you did on the weekend in another town. Right. And the reason that's a bad analogy is that stuff like that happens. But
if you like beat up another student, but if you like were overheard saying something.
Yeah. So that's a little bit infuriating. And again, their terms of service, they can make any rules they want, but it seems unfair. Again, there's no reason it has to be fair. Life isn't fair.
I know that there are some people who take the position. There are some people who take the position that really the only people being banned are, you know, these crazy Nazis, and why should I care about them? Because you know, it's just we're fighting against the alt-right here, and we're fighting against Trump here, and so ban away. And I just, that position is becoming less and less tenable by the day. I think that people are starting to realize that no, that's not what's going on here. And as I pointed out, what was it in the, I don't know if it was the article we did in Alex Jones, how a lot of this banning is being driven by like these interest groups, like these social media reporters that kind of make a big stink about it. And those are not necessarily the people that I want in charge of this thing.
Yeah. I don't recall which episode number it was, but I believe we've mentioned Hatreon before, which it grew out of the same impetus, and it had the exact problem that they're talking about, in that they got it set up and they got it running, and after a short period of time, I don't remember whether it was, you know, several months or if they made it to a year, but the credit card companies who did the payment processing choked that off, and they were the ones that deplatformed the service. And so there are ways you can get around that. The most obvious is to go the crypto route.
So I looked into Hatreon, their most famous kind of recipient. I don't know if you looked into the individual recipients, is this guy known as Weave the Hacker, who openly calls for the country to be like purged of all Jews. So I can't be a friend of his, but I do think this censorship has gone so far, too far, or shouldn't have gone on at all. I mean, it's, I guess you could, a long way to go. If Patreon was only banning people like that, that would be one thing. But when they go all the way to Sargon, I know that's a problem.
So the other thing that was mentioned in the article you shared, and let me just quote it here.
One thing I wanted to put to focus on, because I went on Gab and posted something and immediately got, you know, contacted by Nazis. I looked on it more recently to see if it's changed, and I noticed that there's two tabs. There's a popular tab and a controversial tab. And so when I looked at the controversial tab, that's all Nazis, but the popular tab is just Trumpist. Like, make America great again, you know, stuff. But, you know, so there's basically two flavors that you have to choose from now. So they're expanding.
Yeah, a little off topic from where I was going to go. But, you're not going to see too many people gathering on a place like Gab AI if they haven't already been either explicitly or implicitly run off of the more mainstream service.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So you're definitely going to see a polarizing effect, even if that's not inherent to the design of the platform.
When you talk about free speech, like the First Amendment, that wasn't made to protect people who were professing mainstream opinion.
Well, yeah,
and
certainly.
This isn't about the First Amendment, I know, but like, it's not like you can't say you're for free speech and be like, "Oh,
well, it isn't until it is." Join me on a long walk to get there. So in the article you shared with me, there's a quote here that they talk about Dr. Peterson. Dr. Peterson emphasized throughout the past month that payment processors, the likes of MasterCard and Visa, should not be censoring the accounts they service based on their political bias. So that raises the question. Okay, so let's accept that as a statement of fact, just for argument. Is it okay if they censor on other criteria? And if so, what? The absolutist position would be that no, they can't censor on anything, or maybe you say, well, they can censor based on criminal activity, but nothing else.
Right.
So there's an interesting discussion to be had there. However, they are corporations, and so they are not explicitly bound by the First Amendment. So they can set some sort of terms of service or policy, and as long as they are fulfilling their duties as a corporation and acting within the law, then they can censor whatever accounts they feel are appropriate.
Sure,
there.
But now however, that's a whole discussion. But okay, sorry, go ahead.
So the next step from that though is that these payment processors and the banks with which they are affiliated are not operating in a vacuum. They are influenced, regulated, and sometimes their actions required by the federal government and the state governments. And so there is a documented case of the federal government taking action through it wasn't passing of law or a official regulation, but it was a essentially strongly worded letters advising banks and payment processing companies on how they should participate or not participate in commerce with certain companies and types of companies. In this particular case, it was looking at firearms manufacturers, particularly those that manufactured and sold certain types of firearms.
Legal firearms, I assume.
Yes. And the federal government was basically saying, we would strongly suggest that you do not provide financial services in the terms of business loans, credit card processing, or anything along those lines to these types of companies. And so that arguably borders on the government infringing, pressuring companies to infringe on the ability of legal businesses to conduct their business.
Yeah, they've been doing this for a long time.
And if they do, you know, if they did that to a journalism outfit, if someone came along and said, I don't think that insert bank name here should be providing payroll processing services to the Washington Post because they've said some things that we don't agree with and we feel that they're being un-American. People would be up in arms.
Sure.
You know, there would be pitchforks and torches in the street. And this may not be to that level, but is it that dissimilar? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, so a couple points to make, and then the main point, or actually one.
Yeah.
One
now
point.
That I pushed you down the slippery slope.
Yeah. So I guess, do you remember back when like net neutrality, when Trump's FCC kind of overturned the net neutrality rules?
Well, I'm told we just recently celebrated 1 year without net neutrality,
yes.
And the internet has not withered and died.
Well, but they laid the propaganda on thick with that one, and I remember the point I was making.
Go ahead.
Is that one of the main arguments I heard was that without net neutrality, these internet backbone carriers are going to start discriminating against people with certain political views. Like that was the main argument. And by the way, this argument was put forth by companies like Google and Facebook, which we'll get to in a second. So it is, it just illustrates the point how I feel like there's one group of people who are accusing another group of doing what the first group is doing. And the second point is that Bitcoin is free speech money. It can't be shut down. It can be tracked. So, like, you know, that might give the ability to tax it, or, you know, track down criminals who use it or whatever. But it can't be halted. It can't be frozen. So it is free speech money. And all this discussion about what's the responsibility of a private company, what if a government comes in and tells them, you know, who they could do business with, what if blah, 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 blah. All of that in the next 10 years is just going to become kind of a moot point. It's going to become like it's as much of it's not going to matter as much as people think it is, which is crazy.
I certainly hope so. Yeah, because the classic market argument would be, well, if these credit card companies refuse to process it, then somebody will start their own credit card company that will. But in the current regulatory, political, economic situation, that's not a realistic expectation.
It's never the same. It's that model is never exactly true. It's never like someone starts the same credit card company, because if you start the same credit card company, you evolve into the same thing that the other ones are. It's someone does something completely different and sneaks around the whole system, and that's exactly what this cryptocurrency is doing.
Yeah, with the barriers to entry, you're not going to start a new taxi company and compete with taxi companies. You're going to start an Uber and, you know, work around the regulations to create something new and disruptive.
And now there's talk of disrupting Uber, and, you know, so on and so forth. So with some of the people on Patreon moving to Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
So they haven't announced yet what this new platform service, whatever it's going to be, is called. So for now, we can call it the Uber of Patreons.
Yeah. He's still figuring it out with Gab supporting cryptocurrency, and with certain other currencies, you know, around the world failing and crypto being adopted. I think it's just a matter of time before this stuff starts to take off more and more. And I know that some people in this audience hold Bitcoin and they hold cryptocurrency. When you have a small amount, it's okay to just put it on a wallet on your phone. But if you have a large amount, you want to hold the keys yourself, I would highly recommend that you get a hardware wallet to do that. And one of the best hardware wallets is the Trezor hardware wallet. And if you go to localmaxradio.com/50, I have an affiliate link for you to buy the Trezor and start it out. It's essentially a small computer, very hard to like, almost indestructible, that exists, it has no internet connection, so you can't hack into it, and that you kind of plug that in through USBs to make your transactions, and then you can have a piece of paper elsewhere with the seed, so if you lose that or that gets destroyed, you can always regenerate it. And so the Trezor hardware wallet is really the best way to hold large amount of this cryptocurrency. And so check it out, localmaxradio.com/50 for the affiliate link. How was my first affiliate pitch, Aaron? Oh, by the way, I use one myself. So yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to have to look into that in more detail. I'm sure you will assist me with that.
Yeah.
All this talk of crypto and wallets has actually made me think of possibly a future topic, but I am completely adapted to kind of a cashless existence, where I do everything with credit cards or you know, quick pay through one of my devices, but I don't know a good way to do that with cryptocurrencies yet, and I don't know if the infrastructure is there to make it as quote unquote seamless for everyday purchases, or if there needs to be some development there. But that's something that I would be interested in hearing about. Hearing more about, and maybe some of our other listeners too.
Well, we'll continue to do some research on this and continue to talk about it. Facebook is definitely not advertising this episode, I can tell you that. Okay, in particular, our last episode is Facebook Culture Described as Cult Light. But before we get into that update on, I got a lot of feedback when talking to Miriam about Google and about the James Damore episode where he came out with that that memo that was very upsetting to a lot of people, and then he ended up getting fired. So an anonymous person ended up going on Reddit recently, and he seems pretty credible, could be a woman, seems pretty credible, and said, I helped Google screw over James Damore. And it's very interesting that, you know, someone who's obviously probably a little higher up in Google, although some of this, everything on Reddit kind of needs to be taken with a grain of salt, sort of says that there was, he sort of describes what was going on inside the company as this was happening. I think that the key paragraph is the second paragraph from this person. Unfortunately, the memo started spreading within the company. The floodgates opened, and previously silent employees started talking. To quell dissent, we told executives to write their employees condemning the memo. We manipulated our internal meme gem to bias the ratings towards anti-Damore posts. The head of meme gen is an ally to diversity cause. So meme gen, you know what a meme generator is online, where you can actually create a meme yourself, which is very useful to do.
Sure.
I should do more to the show. So companies have internal meme gens. Like when you have a fun company, you have internal meme gens, I guess. And you could create your own memes within the company and send them back and forth internally. We don't have one at Foursquare, but we do have, and I will talk about this next week, we have lots of internal Foursquare-only emojis in Slack. So... but that's the kind of, we don't use emojis to like send each other upsetting political messages. It's only for fun. and when we want to send memes, we use, we send each other GIFs. We use Giphy.com. Very, very connected to Foursquare.
Wait, do you send GIFs or GIFs?
I call them GIFs. I don't know. Okay. To continue on, Google gave every manager talking points on what to tell their reports, the people that report to them about the memo. In all our communications, we concentrate on how hurt employees purportedly were and diverted attention from Google's discriminatory employment practices and political hegemony, never mind the science. So this has gone way beyond, immediately gone way beyond the stuff that he was actually talking about in the memo. That is no longer relevant. No one wants to talk about that. And it really just becomes about, man, a company just trying to squash something and almost making it worse, because I don't know what they were trying to achieve here. It sounded like, when I spoke to Merriam, and again, that's just my one conversation, it sounded like people saw it, they were angry by it, but they were like, okay, I'm going to move on with my day. But by making this kind of an all hands, unless there was like a internal rumbling that was like kind of like a mob coming from certain sectors, it sounded like they kind of let this pass. Well, that's an interesting point of view, but that's not what we're doing. So thanks very much, James. Go back to your work. You know, it sounded like they really couldn't do that, or decided not to do that.
It's hard to judge whether they overreacted or if their reaction was exactly proportional, but it does sound like, you know, this his memo was passed up through the regular channels, and when he didn't get the reaction he was hoping for from that it was circulating internally, and so there must have been some internal upwelling. Now, whether it was an internal upwelling potentially in support of it that they felt they needed to put down, or it was an upwelling of people who were offended and they felt that it was negatively affecting morale that way and they needed to take action. It certainly seems that they were afraid of where this was going and they needed to try and at least redirect it, if not squash it. From one aspect, it certainly looks like they kind of Streisand affected it, that, And I don't know how the timeline works out in terms of
what's the name of the CEO? I forgot his name. oh my God, I'm drawing a blank here.
It's not Pichai, is it?
Yes, Sundar Pichai. I was about to say Satya Nadella because I was just talking about Microsoft today. Man, I'm getting real confused about Microsoft. Okay, when Sundar Pichai said, fired him, I believe there was already kind of like a chorus of people saying to do it. But he could have just said, we're not doing it and we're moving on. And everybody just stopped this. But I don't know that, I don't know what that would have led to if he made that decision.
Yeah. Well, and this, the whole incident can certainly be painted as once they decided that they needed to squash this, they, you know, okay, we need to de-emphasize the content of the memo and emphasize how he's a bad person and he does a bad job and, you know, paint the messenger, not the message. And it sounds like you can certainly write the story that way. It's unclear in terms of the timeline and how things are presented, whether that was the driver or if that's just a distorted lens look at it.
Right. He also claims they spied on his computer and phone, the Google issued ones, I assume.
Yeah. My initial reaction was, well, if that was his company phone, yeah, that's a crummy thing for them to do, but it's 100% what I would expect.
But they, I think that's what
and,
it was.
And that's, I think that's what the follow-up comments tend to suggest.
Yeah.
But it's not out of the question that they could have gone a step beyond that. And if they had, that would be very concerning. Well, again, not that I know that there's anything we can do to determine that, or if they did, what are we going to do about it? But
from the information I got from Miriam last time, it sounded like it would be very difficult for them to look into his personal stuff, although who knows if there are any backdoors that the people high up have. But I think probably not, although I do know a lot of former Google people at Foursquare, and they tell me, I'll do outside stuff on my Foursquare laptop, but when I was at Google, never.
Hmm.
You know, their big brother is watching. So I don't know if I would be able to work in an environment like that.
Yeah, well, and I have a work phone and a personal phone, but I've already broken kind of the cardinal rule there that I've cross-linked some accounts there just because it makes things easier and convenient. And
sure,
particularly when I'm traveling internationally, my phone doesn't have an international plan, but my work phone does.
Right.
So, but that means that now my company, their IT department, can look into all that stuff that I've cross-linked there. And so I've given up some of my privacy when I probably shouldn't have.
Yeah. Why'd you do that, Aaron? Seriously.
because convenience trumps security nine times out of 10. No, more than 9 times out of 10.
Every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you asked the question, how much of this was rogue elements in management trying to control the situation?
Yeah, and let me clarify that, because I rogue elements maybe paints the wrong picture, but it almost seems like, I guess there are two scenarios. One, that there's kind of an internal policy that was laid out that already kind of pretty much aligned that, you know, if this type of things happens, this is how we have to react, versus this kind of blew up in their face and they said, okay, we need to do anything within our power to make this stop, to get this under control. And so they kind of went beyond their principles and their guidelines a little bit to solve this problem, because when you have a huge problem, you're willing to throw anything at it to fix it.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I found out from episode 45 was that there is an activist culture at Google. And I wonder if some of those internal, like political activists, kind of put flame on the fire, and maybe it's not a good idea to tell people that their political beliefs should come into work. I don't want to have a workplace where it's like you're not allowed to say anything political, but like it's probably not a good idea to say that, you know, no, you could do your political activism at work. That's a perfectly acceptable thing to do in our company. And then all of a sudden you get these warring factions who are supposed to be working together to try to fulfill the mission of Google, which might not be so great, but that's what it is. And instead, you have these ulterior motives that come up that causes these kinds of conflicts.
Yeah, it's hard to know where that line should be drawn, because, like you said, you don't want to have a blanket, you know, ban on anything political or activist related, because that's definitely stifling.
No, but they.
But you don't want to invite that in and foster it when it could potentially. It's either going to
encouraged it
cause a polarizing effect in the workplace where only a certain type of people are there, or it's going to cause, you know, huge conflict to blow up because you've got people who are activists but not necessarily aligned on what they're advocating.
Right. I feel like there were some people who were thinking not what's good for Google, but what's good for my cause internally. And that's
right. And not everybody is going to be, you know, a company man or a company woman.
No, I wouldn't recommend
and
that.
Think about it that way.
But I also wouldn't recommend bringing your personal causes into the workplace in that way. Like, I would recommend writing about it, talking about it on Twitter, talking like going door to door, participating in political campaigns outside work is all fine. But so I don't know. I mean,
think
would you
this maybe transitions?
Would you want like a missionary coming into your workplace and just start trying to convert you to their religion? No. So why would you want? Why would you want the political version of that?
Yeah, well, and I think that transitions well into our next topic here, which kind of gets into
The Facebook.
How one should or should not conduct oneself in the workplace and how that affects your work and your career.
Right. Okay, so getting into this now, we've talked about Patreon, we talked about Google, now we talk about Facebook. Again, except for Patreon, the usual suspects. Although this is... In 2018, it was shocking. Now in 2019, it's just amusing. So far, I don't know. There's a lot of 2019 left, but so far it's just amusing because you have this horrible article in CNBC about Facebook called "Facebook Culture is Described as Cult-like," and a couple focus questions that I want to ask before I get into the meat of this article. Obviously, it's an anti-Facebook article. So the first question I want to ask when reading this is, how much of this is true for all large companies, and how much of this is specific to Facebook or just Silicon Valley giants? There's obviously kind of a tech bubble where everyone thinks the same way, and this might be something that's common to that, but it might be true at a lot of other companies as well. And then the second focus question, which is similar, is that, look, this is negative press about the company. There have been some nasty things written about Foursquare in the past, usually through Business Insider or Mashable, not CNBC. And I know they weren't true or they were huge exaggerations. There was one article in Mashable in 2015 saying all of the engineers at Foursquare are unhappy and they're leaving. And if any engineer is still there, it's because they haven't found the right job yet. And it would be like a source said that employees at Foursquare are outraged that they're like upset that the company hasn't been sold yet. And it's like, all of this is news to me. like who is this anonymous source? It's, you know, it is sort of, and then I know some of the things that have been written about it on Glassdoor from ex-employees who maybe weren't happy, said some things that were definitely like, they've talked about XYZ happened in the company meeting, and I was at the company meeting, and I know that's like an embellishment of reality. So there is sort of a, there's a sense here that you can't always rely on these types of hit pieces, although I have a feeling that a lot of this did resonate with me, so I have a feeling that some of this is true. But I do want to put that out there first.
Yeah, it's that's fair that we can't do much more than take it at face value, but they've been proven to misrepresent in the past. So
yeah, well, journalists
in
general.
That's good to keep in mind.
I don't know about CNBC, but in terms of reporting on this sort of thing, I'm sure if you want to look at CNBC's full repertoire, you can. But anyway, so one of the problems is, and people, I hate this, there's this pressure to feel love at the company. And that is a really rough thing because people can sense the difference between happy employees, like forced happiness, and the real thing.
There was a line in there pretty early on in the article that I saw, and this is when I first realized that I was going to be made fairly angry by reading this.
What made you angry? Because I wasn't so angry. I'm curious to know. Tell me.
So not to generalize about generations, but nowhere in this article do they use the term millennial or you know, phrases about, oh, millennials are the worst. But all I could think about when I was reading this is, this is people who don't understand what it's like to work in a real job, complaining about what it's like to work in a real job. So the first line that ticked me off was fall in line with their manager's orders and force cordiality with their colleagues so they can advance. That if you want to get ahead at work, you got to be friendly with the people you work with. I mean, there are two paths. You can be a terrible human being and really, really good at your job and still manage to get ahead.
I don't like those people.
Or you can also be good at your job and be decent to the human beings around you, and you're going to get a lot farther. And so the outrage that you have to be friendly to the people you work with, that immediately set off red flags. That what kind of human beings are these? That alone does not make a place a cult.
Sure. And that's, yes, I totally agree with you. But I do want to talk about the feedback system for a minute, because there are actual problems with the feedback system as they describe it. And it's a common feedback system. It's a peer feedback system. We have them at Foursquare. We had them at Wireless Generation. And you have sort of anonymous people writing in.
Well, there are two elements to it. One isn't mentioned until fairly late in the article.
Yeah.
That it was originated at GE, and that's the whole rack 'em and stack 'em philosophy. That basically everybody gets ranked, and based on your ranking determines, you know, who gets promotions and who gets raises, and potentially, you know, at some places they've got a policy that, you know, the bottom 5% all get fired. Every quarter or every year or whatever. And so that's a piece of it, but that's not necessarily coupled with the peer review process, which it sounds like it is in this case.
Yeah, it is. And the peer review process can be very frustrating if you're getting negative anonymous feedback from a source where you don't know where, and the person giving anonymous feedback, well, they don't have any costs imposed on themselves, so people can have an ulterior motive for doing that. And so that can create a situation that is very frustrating and very uncomfortable and very bad for a company culture. I'm trying to think back. Like, I received some negative feedback early in my career at Wireless Generation, and it was pretty obvious. Like, first, your first thought is who said this, and then it like becomes pretty obvious who it is. And then secondly, it's just like, okay, like that person doesn't like me, and it must be because they suck. So, and then that's just how you go about your day. And it's just, it's not very helpful. And then the fact that you have these charges, they say, that follow you around, because if you get one half of negative feedback, then your manager, the next feedback cycle around, is not like sticking out his, like he has to give someone negative feedback. And
yeah, well, and there's definitely inertia to your career, regardless of whether you're on a self or a peer assessment,
and that's why
process or not.
I don't want it's a very bad idea to have your career tied up in advancement in a single company, because this stuff always goes on, and it's better to be entrepreneurial. You don't have to necessarily start your own company. But I feel like, especially in this time in tech, you're better off, you know, proving your worth at multiple companies and having your work speak for itself and advancing that way.
There's certainly something to be said for that.
Yeah. And there's this also interesting thing where they're great on a curve, like you said. So like 5% have to have the bottom. And the grading system is very subjective. And one of the problems they have here is that, so there's an objective portion and there's a subjective portion, right? And it sounds like the subjective portion of it is all driven by, political, office politics, well, whatever that means.
I don't think it's intended but it becomes... You know, whatever. I'm sure that they have to justify their ranking
if you're losing,
but you can't combat it. You know, so you have to take the peer assessments as written to be genuine, unless they explicitly call something out that's contradicted by.
Of course, it's always the case.
Other reviewers,
if you're not doing well, it's office politics. If you're doing well, like the subjective system works to some degree, but I think the office politics model is not wrong. And then people definitely want to shy away from using the years of experience. So when I spoke to Camille Fournier about management, she said people really did not want to be assessed on their years of experience. They really wanted to be on how much they contributed, kind of a meritocracy. But
yeah.
I feel like there maybe should be some component of that where it's like, okay, there's no good way to measure this objectively. So you have a certain number of years of experience and that will get you so far. But I don't know. That's just something to think about. And then on the objective side, it gets even worse, I think, because objective performance is when they kind of create these metrics at the top, and the metrics always cause employees to optimize the wrong thing. Like, how much product did you ship out? And you know, or how many things you ship out, and then of course that makes people ship things out early. Or
there are fields where that makes sense. So if you're in sales, then it's real easy to do a rack 'em and stack 'em system. It's, you know, what was your quota? Did you hit it? If you exceeded it, by how much? And then we rank everybody according. And you know, if you're a salesperson, you could be, you know, the most abrasive, unliked person in the office. But if you are breaking your numbers, you know, you're smashing through them every quarter, you're going to get your bonuses, and you're going to get ranked and potentially promoted along those lines.
Sure.
If you're an engineer contributing to a team project, it's a lot harder to quantify. I mean, are you going to say lines of code submitted?
Oh, that's terrible.
You know, divided by number of bugs, that you're responsible for, and you can try and quantify all that, but yeah, like you said, then you're going to get optimizing for some formula that does not necessarily translate into the best interests of the company mission.
Yeah, and a lot of the issues with engineers is we're always thinking, not, I shouldn't say we're always, that's a bad term, but engineers often have to think very long term. Like, I'm going to write some code this is going to be around for several years. I'm going to create some systems that's going to be around for several years, and so we're often in a position where we're fighting for kind of long-term thinking in terms of taking care of the company's assets, which is its code base and database and information and patterns and that sort of thing. And if you have all these objective metrics, then that kind of behavior is not rewarded, but is punished. And it's sort of a situation, like I said, when I was talking last week with Daniele, did you listen to that one yet?
Actually, I did, yes.
Oh, good, because that just came out today, I believe.
Yeah, I listened to it this morning.
Right, it's like over-optimization on things that you can measure. And in the case of engineering, and this happens again and again and again, where engineers are just pushed to doing things quick and dirty. And there's some of that that you want to do, particularly when you're making a new product and trying out new things. But eventually, like, you know, management starts to get greedy and says, well, things, you know, things should, well, like when Facebook started out, right? Move quickly and break things. And that's great when you're starting out and putting out a new product. But then management gets complacent and they sort of think, well, it's cheap to produce things, so we should just produce a ton of things and push them to produce more things harder rather than thinking short term or long term. So there's a lot of short term thinking going on throughout the industry. And it comes up again and again. Even when you have a situation where it's good, it always seems to devolve back to that. Very frustrating.
Yeah. So on the short term versus long term thing, I have two thoughts. One, they make the comment that because they're on a half year review cycle, that you find the reviews are completed in August and February, so yeah, people end up working, you know, overtime and really cranking the productivity in June and December respectively, and they're complaining about that, and I think specifically about the, you know, working nights and weekends to impress bosses right before reviews.
And that's, by the way, when you join a company, that's the last thing you want to be doing. Like,
true. However, any industry or profession where you've got some sort of financial performance metric that you're being measured by, you got to hit those quarterly numbers or those yearly targets. You're going to get the same thing. People are cramming in at the end of the quarter to get that last piece that they're missing. Heck, you get it with police officers that in a system where there's quotas, you know, they're coming up on the last of the month, and I got to get out there and get X more citations so that I don't get written up for slacking on the job.
Sure.
So that happens. maybe your argument is that, well, we should do it less frequently, so that only happens in December instead of in June and December. And my counter to that would be, where I work, we're on a yearly review cycle.
Yeah, me too.
And my big complaint about that is, yeah, I don't want to go through that process more frequently, but if you get, you know, useful concrete feedback once a year, that's not enough to actually make a meaningful difference in your performance.
But let me ask you this.
And maybe that doesn't require a full-up review, but I'll be honest, our mid-year review process is kind of meaningless.
Let me ask you this, Aaron, though. Would you want to be working late nights all of December just to, like, prove your worth for the entire year? That's not – nobody would look at that and say, oh, that's healthy. That's the way this should work. Nobody when designing their feedback system is like, yeah, and then in December, they're going to do all the work that they're going to be judged on, and they're going to stay late, and then that's how I see this working. Nobody thinks it. So,
I sympathize with that, but I think it's a feedback system that they're feeding back into. Feedback in the sense of management feedback, but in the sense of control loops here.
Yeah, I do want to bring this back to machine learning, because we talk about machine learning a lot in that, you know, people say machine learning is going to solve all these problems. But like I said, when you do machine learning, you have to give it an objective function. What are you trying to optimize? And so this shows that objective functions are hard. And oftentimes, you know, you've got to, when you specify an objective function, yes, the machine learns to make those, hit those numbers, but then it turns out to be not exactly what you wanted because the world's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So a couple other points here. Right, when people feel pressure to love the company, that's really not something that I like. I like a more open culture. I really enjoyed, I had a team from 2017 at Foursquare who I really enjoyed because I felt like that was the most emotionally expressive team that I've ever had. And I could feel their ups and downs. And I almost felt like it was more real, like I could trust how they were feeling all the time. And because there were both ups and downs, I don't know, I just felt more of a connection there. And that was just a point I wanted to make on that. Another point was that Facebook has been rated on Glassdoor as the best place to work, number one for many years. Now it's down to 7. I don't know how much that stuff could be trusted. Again, it does sound like a gaming system.
Yeah, I had a note.
But look, if they're brainwashing employees to always say best place to work, post us on Glassdoor, that does sort of make sense.
Well, I think there's two things there. One, that the fall from 1 to 7, that they make it sound like that's a precipitous slip. But out of how many companies?
Hundreds, thousands.
If you're still in the top, you know, 0.0001% of companies, I feel like that's a pretty negligible difference.
But wait a minute, do you think that's really an objective measure? Because a lot of these companies
have
100 people.
Objective, well, but how else are you going to measure it?
Well, a lot of these companies have 100 people, and there's no way they're going to get into the top 10, even if everybody said yes.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
But and so of companies in the running. Yeah, I don't really know what that means. And then another problem.
I would say that drop from 1st to 7th, there are two things that I'd take away from that. Maybe that makes a difference in the ultra tight labor market where you're competing with the other cool tech behemoths or with new startups in Silicon Valley. And so if somewhere else seems to have a better tech work life balance, then that'll drive people elsewhere. I don't think that's super likely. But the other piece of that is I think a lot of the problems they're having are related to their identity as like you said, this go fast and break things, this cool, hip new startup, which they were, a decade ago.
Right.
But they aren't anymore. And along those same lines, people are expecting the kind of review process and workplace environment that comes in a Silicon Valley startup, which may be where a lot of these people worked previously or go to after this. But that's not what Facebook is. Facebook is a stock exchange traded megacorp.
Yeah.
And with that growth comes formal policies and all this kind of pardon my French, but the corporate bullshit that you encounter in a place like that. And, you know, I've had review processes that were similar to this from my first job out of college that continue today, perhaps with more or less of a peer review aspect of it. But there's a trade-off in that there too, that they want a more egalitarian workplace and you know, a flatter corporate structure. They want to feel like they're being assessed on their actual performance and the people around them. And so you trade off having, you know, a single manager who basically determines the trajectory of your entire career at that company to having input from the people around you.
Yeah.
And of course they claim, oh, we want to have the opportunity to be our authentic self and encourage real dissent. And that's important to them when it comes to criticizing the company. But when their coworkers want to provide their authentic self and real dissent about the performance of their colleagues, they're saying, well, that's unfair because it's anonymous and I can't lash back at that.
Yeah.
And I recognize that yeah, there's some downsides to it, but you can't have your cake and eat it too here.
So one more point that they had in the article, which is also very common in a lot of companies, was the frustration with the company not practicing what is being preached at the top. And I mention this because this is so, so common. Even I would say it's happened at Foursquare. It's happened at companies that I like. Usually when it's a company that I don't like, it's a lot more stark. But the top always says, the people on the top always says, we want ideas to come from the bottom up. We want you to speak up. We want to have an open culture. And I believe they always wish it. Like, I would wish it if I were in that position, but it's very difficult to bring it about. They're not always competent in bringing it about. I don't know if I would be in bringing it about, but it is, I feel like maybe it would help if the people at the top were a little bit more, you know, humble about this is what I would like to see, but it's not always true. And so let's try to, I'm just going to put out there that it might be worse at Facebook, but this is not uncommon either. Have you experienced this, Aaron?
It's across the board. It does not know language, cultural, or you know, national bounds. It happens at companies of all size. We say we want one thing, and the moment the response we're getting doesn't align with what we want and expect in reality, we tend to lash back at it. It's not a unique problem to Facebook.
Everyone wants to hear,
but it's perhaps more visible there because we like to dump on them.
Everyone wants open and honest discussion until they hear something they don't want to hear. But
I want open and honest discussion that confirms my beliefs.
If
you disrupt my priors, then that can't possibly be open and honest.
And if it's something I don't care, if it's something I don't care about, there could be vigorous debate from all sides. Just to wrap this up, let me give my personal opinion on what I think about Facebook, because I think that some of this is true. And like I said, a lot of this is very common at a lot of other companies. But at Facebook, you have a situation where they went from, as you said, startup to to stock exchange, megacorp, very quickly. They went from idealistic to try to like be very, I want to say like squash the little guy, but I'm not talking about squashing other companies, but they went from being idealistic in terms of free speech to no, this is our platform, and there are only certain things you could say on it very quickly. And I think that the management has never been challenged in this way for many years, and so now it's got to be worse at Facebook and other companies.
Yeah, well, and it's definitely growing pains, and that doesn't excuse it. That doesn't make a solution to it easier.
It's the fact that they've grown pains, but it's also just the fact that this company is not. It doesn't have a mission anymore. Its mission was to connect everyone, and now its mission seems to be to influence everyone, to control everyone, and people are realizing, hey, I'm not really liking what I'm doing here, and so now it's people.
Well,
are just,
I'd say their their actual mission is to keep people engaged and keep them on the platform. And they certainly influencing them and manipulating them is one way to maximize that. And so I don't think that's their objective, but it's the strongest tool they have in their toolbox.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think that's enough bad news for one day. I think we're going to move on. So there is some good news here in that, you know, these are, as we head into the last year of the 2010s, these companies are starting to show cracks in their armor and other systems are coming in to replace them. You have Bitcoin and cryptocurrency replacing Patreon and the credit card companies, and you're going to start to see alternatives to these social networks and these search giants pretty soon. I think the fact that all this stuff is coming to light, where it felt, I really feel a difference where it felt very frustrating the last couple of years, and now it feels like, oh, these guys are old news. And next week, you're going to hear my conversation with Avnish about how Microsoft used to be the company that everyone hated, and they kind of turned things around a little bit too. We'll see if the same thing can happen or if these guys will just be completely replaced. But it's a long period. People are going to have patience. And hey, you might as well laugh at it as we go. Although the Facebook one was hard to laugh at because a lot of this stuff hits home. But
I don't know if it came up in your interview about Microsoft, but it was mentioned in the article here that this ranking system and peer review was quote unquote famously employed at Microsoft until they stopped
in 2013, which is when Avnish joined. So very interesting. He said that he kind of witnessed a turnaround.
Ah, okay. So I like I said, I don't know if that came up in your discussion, but I'd be curious to see how it played into the whole, like you said, the turnaround there and kind of where they're at. So I'm eagerly looking forward to listening to that.
All right, wonderful. I'm glad that we didn't get to the CES and 5G tech stuff because it's already been an hour. we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. And remember localmaxradio.com/50 to get the show notes for this, plus the link to the Trezor hardware wallet if you want to be a part of the crypto revolution. Anything else, Aaron?
No, that sounds good to me.
All right. See you next week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. The show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
And she said, I don't care what you say, you're gonna see me shine.